Lecture 23, Competing European Empires.
In 1494, the Portuguese and Spanish kings divided the non-Christian world between them. This was the famous Treaty of Tordesillas, sanctioned by the Pope, that gave Brazil, Africa, and all of Asia up to Japan, to the Portuguese king, and everything else to the Spanish monarch. But no one in India or the world could have foretold the long-term consequences when a fleet of small Portuguese ships containing about 150 men under Vasco da Gama sailed around the Cape of Good Hope, up the east coast of Africa, and crossed the Indian Ocean in 1498. This royal expedition entered a world almost completely unknown to Europeans, but rumored to be full of riches and Christians. Yet this began what many call the Age of Vasco da Gama, initiating European colonialism in Asia, a vital step in globalization. More European adventurers, merchants, and missionaries would follow over subsequent centuries. Most were organized into what became the world's first international capitalist corporations. Most prominent of these were the English East India Company, which began in 1600, the Dutch East India Company, established 1602, the French East India Company, founded 1664. Each was the early product of economic and social transformations in Northern Europe that would eventually lead to the Industrial Revolution and the rise of the middle classes. In this lecture, we'll first look at the Portuguese, who rapidly expanded around the world with the Indian west coast city of Goa as the center of their oceanic empire in Asia. As we know, Portugal is a relatively small European nation in size and population, yet it created a global empire. So we'll discuss how and why the Portuguese quickly gained control over the seas around India and dominated its international trade until the early 18th century, when other Europeans took over. We'll next discuss the competing East India companies that sought to profit from India's exports, especially the English East India Company. They had decisive advantages over the Portuguese: technological, financial, organizational, and cultural. These companies gradually linked with a range of Indian merchants, administrators, and soldiers to create new commercial and political opportunities for each other. However, by the mid-18th century, 250 years after Vasco da Gama reached the shores of India, Europeans still held only coastal enclaves and a few trading posts in the interior of the subcontinent. Nonetheless, the consequences of these early interactions between diverse Indians and Europeans would dramatically alter the world, as we know from our own lives. Going back even before Alexander the Great fought his way through the western borderlands of India in the 4th century BCE, Europeans had imagined distant India as a fabulously wealthy land, the source for spices, fine cloths, and exotic luxuries. But especially following the Ottoman capture of Constantinople in 1453, the rising Muslim Ottoman Empire came to control European access east across the Mediterranean to the rich Orient. So the Portuguese used their strategic location on the southwestern corner of Europe's Atlantic coast to their advantage. Armed explorers under the sponsorship of the Portuguese king developed advancing naval technology and growing navigational skills to try to reach Asia by sailing south around Africa. Thus, the expedition of Vasco da Gama was only a high point in a long series of Portuguese expeditions appointed and funded by the Portuguese king. These first Portuguese entered the Indian Ocean world of thriving seaborne commerce among Indians, Africans, Arabs, Ottomans, and Persians. Indeed, Vasco da Gama was able to find India only with the guidance of local seamen experienced in long-distance navigation across the Indian Ocean. Since we now know about the centuries of European colonialism that follows, we can anticipate the long-term consequences for India and the world that followed, even if these explorers did not. The first Portuguese vessels landed at Calicut, a port in the southwestern province of Kerala, now again called by its Indian name, Kozhikode. They first had to figure out who they had discovered. Since they did not really know about Hinduism, they assumed all the non-Muslim peoples living in India were Christians. When they entered a Hindu goddess temple, they prayed to what they thought was, quote, a small image of Our Lady, although it had an Indian face and clothing and probably multiple arms. One of Vasco da Gama's men reported this, quote, the city of Calicut is of Christians who are dark men, and some of them have certain topknots on their crowns as a sign that they are Christians, and they wear much gold in them. The women in this land wear much gold jewelry around their necks, and on their toes they have rings of precious stones. All these people are well-mannered and suave. Close quote. It took the Portuguese several more voyages to realize that they were dealing with mostly Hindus, not Christians, although there were some Christians around. Now, throughout recorded history, the coastal region of Kerala was where many diverse outsiders had come to trade and some to settle. Recall that communities of Jews, Syrian Orthodox Christians, and Muslims had lived there for centuries. There were also occasionally Chinese and Malay and other Southeast Asian ships sailing into Kerala's harbors. So the arrival of these Portuguese strangers from the sea was not a surprise. But how these latest visitors acted was shocking. The Indian Ocean had long experienced violence with armed conflicts among various coastal kingdoms and roving pirates. However, the Portuguese ships, known as caravels, were more heavily armed than anything else afloat in that ocean. Designed to brave the stormy Atlantic, these ships had overlapping planks nailed to a sturdy framework. This allowed many more powerful cannon to be mounted lower in the hull for stability. These caravels were also relatively fast and maneuverable. Thus, they were the world's most advanced naval technology of the day. These naval advantages and Portuguese ruthlessness raised the intensity of the violence in the Indian Ocean world. Vasco da Gama and his Portuguese successors mercilessly proved their might by seizing and burning rival Indian, Arab, African, Jewish, and Ottoman vessels and slaughtering the captive crews and passengers. The Portuguese did not accept ransoms, as was customary. Indeed, they often acted with a millenarian determination to destroy Muslims. This was an extension of Mediterranean wars between Christians and Muslims that went back to the Crusades and continued during the Ottoman Empire. In fact, in a series of naval battles, the Portuguese defeated the war fleets that the Ottoman Empire sent from bases in Egypt to try to control the Indian Ocean. The Portuguese Empire along the shores of India expanded greatly after 1509 under Viceroy Afonso de Albuquerque. A nobleman and experienced military commander, he established a chain of fortified Portuguese enclaves along the coasts of India and China. Many of these, like Diu and Bombay, were islands that were easily defended against attacks from land. The largest Portuguese coastal enclave and the capital of his empire in Asia was Goa, which was protected from Indian land-based kingdoms by a river and canal. But the Portuguese ships could not carry much cargo. So the Portuguese concentrated in the pepper trade, where a small volume of freight could sell in Europe for many times its cost in India. Since the Portuguese did not have enough capital to purchase as much pepper as they wanted at prevailing market prices, they often blockaded other outlets and excluded other buyers so as to force down the price and raise the supply offered to them. The Portuguese king also profited by forcing all non-Portuguese ships crossing the Indian Ocean to purchase a cartaz, that is a license or pass from authorities in Goa or another Portuguese outpost. This was a document bearing a Christian cross. The Portuguese warships seized any ship that lacked a cartaz. So this license was really protection money, as when you pay a young man to protect your car when parked in a dangerous neighborhood. If you don't pay the protection money, it will cost you far more in damages. However, Muslim, Hindu, Jewish, and other non-Christian merchants often objected to the cartaz fee and also to the requirement that they sail under the protection of the Christian cross. But no Indian ruler, including the Mughal emperor, had a navy that could face the Portuguese. So this Carta system brought a steady stream of fees to the Portuguese crown. This system also forced all merchant ships in the Indian Ocean to visit Portuguese-controlled ports, which enhanced their commercial importance. Further, individual Portuguese officials and officers got only a small salary from their king. So to make more money, they invested their personal capital with local merchants in the intra-Indian Ocean trade. Thus, the Portuguese Empire in India proved profitable for both the king and his employees. But it was really parasitic, and it did not radically disrupt the ongoing Indian Ocean trade or deeply affect the inland economy of India, at least directly. Indirectly, however, there were substantial consequences of the establishment of the Portuguese Empire in India. For one thing, the Portuguese imported various new crops from the Americas. These included tomatoes, potatoes, and chili peppers, which spread widely. It's hard for us today to think of Indian food without these New World crops. Invasive species and diseases affecting plants and people also arrived with the Portuguese. So did the more destructive European-style cannon and other gunpowder weapons that spread inland as Indian rulers purchased them and hired Portuguese mercenaries to fire them in every ever bloodier wars. The Portuguese also tried to convert Indians to Roman Catholic Christianity. From 1578 onward, there were almost always Jesuit Catholic missionaries at the Mughal imperial court. This Jesuit conversion strategy was to start at the top with the ruler and then use his influence to convert his subjects. These missionaries sent back detailed descriptions of what they saw there. They also made overly optimistic claims that the Mughal emperor himself was about to convert. While the Portuguese did increase the number of Roman Catholics in India, these were never more than a tiny fraction of the population. Many of them were descendants of Portuguese men who married Indian women and raised their children as Catholics. Yet others were communities of people who had low status within Hinduism and sought to better their social standing by converting to Catholicism. But a large number of Indian Catholics were converted from Syrian Christianity. These people had already been living along the southwest coast for over 1,000 years. These Eastern Rite Syrian Christians often proved to be useful commercial and political allies for the Portuguese. They provided local knowledge to their fellow Christians while receiving some favorable policies from the Portuguese in their coastal enclaves. But many Portuguese believed that they had the religious duty to convert Syrian Orthodox communities to the true Roman Catholic form of Christianity. So from 1560, the Portuguese set up an Inquisition and pressured Syrian Christians to convert to Roman Catholicism, which many did, but not all. While the Portuguese were the most powerful seaborne state, they never extended their territories inland. Instead, the Mughal imperial dynasty expanded across India's land during the late 16th and the 17th centuries, as you'll recall. The Mughals, who actually arrived in India almost 30 years after the Portuguese, proved able to control the Portuguese on land whenever they became too disruptive. For instance, when the Portuguese naval vessels captured especially important merchant and pilgrim ships, the emperors punished Portuguese settlements. For instance, in 1632, Mughal imperial forces captured the Portuguese commercial and military base at Hooghly in coastal Bengal after a relatively short but bloody land and riverine campaign. 400 prisoners were herded to the imperial court. These were European men and also men and women of mixed European, Asian, biological, or cultural ancestry. Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan released those who converted to Islam, but he imprisoned or distributed the rest as slaves to his courtiers. But the major Portuguese enclaves at Goa, Daman, and Diu remained in their hands for 4.5 centuries until the Republic of the Independent Nation of India seized and annexed them in 1961. Thus, the Portuguese Empire we are considering first in this lecture remained largely oriented toward the sea, toward profits, and toward Roman Catholic Christianity. In the long term, the Portuguese Empire had more limited effects on India than did the various northern East India companies, to which we'll turn next. The sea passage around the southern tip of Africa that the Portuguese had pioneered, and the knowledge and wealth they brought back, excited northern European travelers and merchants. Increasingly, returning Europeans recounted and published their adventures, often with fanciful details describing the unimaginable riches of the Orient. They told of exotic wonders like Indian harems filled with beautiful women whom they glimpsed. For example, the French physician and adventurer François Bernier spent 9 years in India, 1658 to 67. In his memoir, titled in English Travels in the Mughal Empire, he explained how he enticed noblewomen to appear before him unveiled by offering medical attention or by giving sweets to the children of their households. Overall, these early European visitors also reported the trading opportunities for inexpensive but fine quality Indian man-made and natural products that awaited exploitation. Not until the early 17th century, however, more than a century after the Portuguese first reached India, did English, Dutch, French, and other northern Europeans begin to organize commercial voyages to India. On New Year's Eve 1600, Queen Elizabeth I, the 67-year-old Virgin Queen, bestowed a royal charter on a group of London merchants who wanted to tap into the vast wealth of the Indies. Although she really knew virtually nothing about the Orient, Queen Elizabeth decreed that this new English corporation would have a monopoly over all trade there, from southern Africa all the way to the Philippines. This royal charter also allowed this English East India Company to use force and establish trading posts to advance its commercial goals. This English East India Company represented the beginning of a new economic world order. Earlier, when an individual European merchant had sent out a ship full of his own trade goods to Asia, he took a massive risk over the year or more until the ship returned, if it ever did. Indeed, during the 17th century, roughly half of English ships and men who set out for Asia never returned. But when a corporation with many shareholders sent out ships, the risk was spread among them. Further, the profits from the cargoes that did return were large enough to cover the losses and also pay dividends to all the stockholders. In its early decades, the English East India Company paid off all of its owners after each successive voyage. But eventually, it became a continuing enterprise with the stockholders, called proprietors, electing a court or board of directors. These directors regularly managed the sending and coming of fleets of ships, the storage and sale of cargoes that they brought back, and the ongoing investment of the corporation's capital. This company had a growing number of permanent employees with expanding archives of detailed records. It used an expanding fleet of specially designed ships that it hired on long-term contracts. All this meant that the competing English, Dutch, and French East India companies had the potential to become much bigger than the Portuguese royal enterprise. English and other northern European shipwrights knew how to build larger vessels than the Portuguese caravels. These so-called East Indiamen ships could carry enough cannon to protect themselves against the Portuguese, the pirates of the Indian Ocean, and the small coastal forces of Indian rulers. These East Indiamen also had much more capacious holds, so they could purchase bulkier goods like cotton and silk cloth, indigo dye, and saltpeter for gunpowder. Indian products reached a growing number of Europeans and Africans. Cotton cloth, for example, was far more comfortable next to the skin than were the woolens and linens produced in northern Europe. Along the West African coast, European slave captains traded Indian cloth for human slaves. In Southeast Asia, Indian cloth was traded for spices. Growing numbers of Indian weavers began working to supply that export market, some 80,000 in Bengal alone by the mid-18th century. So this substantially larger volume of imports and exports by these East India companies affected India's and the world economy even more than spices had done. But these East India companies faced the major challenges of getting and protecting these Indian products. Their early merchant fleets carried cargoes of Northern European products like woolens, but these did not sell very well in India, as you can imagine. So increasingly, these outgoing East India Company ships carried gold and silver bullion to purchase Indian products. Indeed, from the time of the Roman Empire onward, Europeans had worried about their trade deficit that was draining precious metals from Europe and shipping them to India. Since Indians valued gold and silver very highly, India had long been a bullion sink where much went in, but little ever flowed out. Historians have traced the massive flow of silver and gold taken from the Americas by the Portuguese and Spanish, used to pay Northern Europeans for dried cod fish and woolens, and then shipped to India to purchase products there. This led by the late 17th century to disruptive inflation in the Indian economy, which reinforced the financial problems of the already declining Mughal Empire. Only with the later establishment of British colonialism was this flow of gold and silver reversed, moving from India to Europe, as we'll see. At first, the East India Company's stockholders were mainly interested in profitable trade, with as few expenses from political or military entanglements as possible. The relatively few East India Company merchants who reached India soon developed partnerships with Indian merchants, bankers, and brokers who negotiated and profited as middlemen between Europeans and the Indian producers. These classes of Indians thus often found more opportunities working with Europeans than they had living under the aristocratic and non-commercially minded Mughal emperors and their imperial governors. From the start, the East India Companies sent out envoys to the Mughal emperor and to local regional rulers seeking rights to trade, tax concessions, and land on which to build their warehouses. For example, the very first English ships to reach India were commanded by William Hawkins, a much-traveled English diplomat, merchant, sea captain, and adventurer. Three Indian seamen who had come to London via Portugal sailed with him, providing knowledge of the Indian Ocean. In 1608, Hawkins reached the major port of Surat on India's west coast. Hawkins went to the Mughal imperial court representing King James I and the English East India Company. While his 3 years in India failed to obtain a permanent license to trade in India, he had a marriage arranged by the Mughal emperor Jahangir himself with one of his courtiers' daughters. This woman, Mariam, was an Armenian Christian who had become the emperor's ward when her father had died. She returned with Hawkins to England, although he died on the two-year voyage home. Widowed Mariam, however, remarried in London, and after more than 2 years there, went back with her new husband to India. Her second English husband, Gabriel Towerson, however, abandoned her when he went to Indonesia. Towerson was killed by the Dutch there. But this shows how Indians and Europeans interacted in Europe as well as in India, and how there was as much fighting among Europeans as between them and Indians. While Hawkins failed to establish a permanent presence for the English East India Company, later envoys successfully did so. On the West Coast, the English East India Company built a warehouse at Surat in 1613, but then when Surat Harbor silted up, they shifted to Bombay in 1668. The islands of Bombay had earlier been a Portuguese enclave, but went to the English King Charles II as part of the dowry of the Portuguese princess Catherine of Braganza. Incidentally, the New York borough of Queens is also named after the same Portuguese princess turned British queen. King Charles then leased Bombay to the East India Company for a nominal rent. The company also got land in Southeast India, principally set in Madras in 1639 and Bengal in Calcutta at 1690. While each of these three, Bombay, Madras, and Calcutta, grew into major cities, none had been more than a tiny village before the English East India Company built warehouses and then fortresses there. They had to be fortified since they contained treasuries for the purchase of valuable Indian products awaiting shipment to Europe. This was also a period of much conflict in India. Over the 18th century, the Mughal Empire fragmented as its governors broke away to create their own kingdoms, and as new regional powers like the Marathas rose up through conquest. These many competing rulers and warlords regarded these European enclaves as an easy source for taxes and plunder. But the experience of the many long 18th century European wars meant that European military science was developing fast. European generals learned that well-disciplined infantry could be trained to almost mechanically perform the loading and firing of muskets, even when being attacked by charging cavalry. Their removable long bayonets allowed their muskets to serve as stabbing weapons during close combat. Industrializing factories produced weapons to exacting standards using interchangeable parts and bullets that fit every gun. Every man wore the same uniform, which made him feel part of a military machine. Superior cannon, manufactured in larger numbers, were used effectively in coordination with the infantry. New designs for fortresses made them defensible, even against improving cannon. All this new software of military discipline and hardware of military equipment created a military revolution in Europe. The European employees of the East India companies might have been hired as merchants, but some of them mastered the lessons of Europe's military revolution and used it to defend and extend their growing territorial acquisitions there. But these European East India companies required far more manpower than they wanted or could afford to import from Europe. European soldiers were expensive to recruit, ship to India, and maintain there. Plus, many died on the passage or from disease or from their licentious lifestyles in India. So the English hired Indian soldiers, either individuals or whole contingents, starting around 1660. These Indian soldiers became known as sepoys when they were trained and armed in the European style. These sepoy infantry regiments then almost always defeated the larger cavalry-based armies of Indian rulers. Adventurous young Indian men volunteered for employment in these East India Company's armies. Many came from families with traditions of military service to one or another competing regional ruler or the Mughal Empire. But the European companies paid better salaries and did so more regularly. Also, they seemed to be winning most of the battles. So many Indian young men wanted to enlist. At its peak, the English East India Company armies contained a quarter of a million Indian sepoy volunteers. The French and English sepoy armies grew and fought each other as various European wars extended into Asia. The European War of Austrian Succession in the 1740s is known in the US as one of the French and Indian Wars. In 1745, the English and their American colonists captured the fortress of Louisbourg on Cape Breton Island, Canada, from the French. The next year in India, the French East India Company captured Madras from the English East India Company. So in the 1748 peace treaty at Aix-la-Chapelle, London and Paris agreed to swap back Louisbourg and Madras. Eventually, English control over the oceans and greater commercial success globally meant that the French were driven out of India. The Dutch East India Company concentrated its efforts in Indonesia. So by the late 18th century, the English East India Company dominated the other Europeans in the Indian Ocean region. The volume of trade exploded, with English imports from India rising over 500% between 1670 and 1740. By the mid-18th century, the English East India Company was poised to expand across India, although few at that time would have predicted that. We'll consider how and why this happened and the consequences for both Indians and Britons in the next lecture.